takes us to our final case on calendar for today, Santalla v. United States District Court for the Northern District of California. Counsel for petitioner, please approach and proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Ivy Ngo and I represent petitioner Sweta Santalla. This court's analysis in In Re Mercio already explains why the first, second, and fourth Bowman factors weigh in favor of mandamus relief here. The only question before the court is, in calculating the losses of competing movements in a securities fraud class action, does a court have unfettered discretion to replace the movement's actual purchase prices with an artificial purchase price just before the end of the class period?
So is it your position that purchase price always has to be part of the calculation?
Yes.
Why do you say that?
There's three reasons that we've laid out where the purchase price must be considered. The first is the plain text of the PSLRA. The PSLRA only provides one part of it where it provides any type of damage formula. And in that formula, it's what we call a cap on the damages. And in that formula, it indicates the actual purchase price with the sale price, and the sale price is only adjusted to take into account the stock price movement in the 90 days after the alleged corrective disclosure. So the plain text of the PSLRA dictates using the actual purchase price. There's no other place in the PSLRA that lays out any type of damage formula. And in the one place it does, it uses the actual purchase price. The second reason that the actual purchase price must be used is that otherwise the court makes inappropriate findings at the lead plaintiff stage in order to use any other price but the actual purchase price. For two reasons that's inaccurate. The first is the pleading standard. It is clear under Twombly and its progeny that plausibility is what is applied at the pleading stage. It would be illogical for a more strict standard to be applied at an earlier stage, at the lead plaintiff stage. Indeed, district courts that have ruled on this issue have either applied the plausibility standard or a lower, obviously frivolous standard. And in either of those scenarios, the actual purchase price is what would be used. It's in accordance with promoting what the PSLRA intends, which is to appoint the movement with the greatest financial interest in the case, not, I believe, what the district court would argue or had said that she was trying to be accurate with the losses. Accuracy is not a part of the PSLRA lead appointment process.
Why was the district court unreasonable in trying to exclude losses that might be potentially unrecoverable under Dura?
The other part of the PSLRA that's clear is the PSLRA discovery stay. So before a case gets past the motion to dismiss process, there is no discovery being done. The initial complaints in these cases are filed before any discovery is made, before any findings are made. And so the intent of the PSLRA in setting up the lead plaintiff process was to prevent a merits-based analysis before the motions to dismiss process. So for the lead plaintiff stage, the most simple application of a loss calculation would be based on the actual purchase price, which is before the court when they receive lead plaintiff papers.
Right, but what if there's allegations and information before the court, even at this early stage, that there's been a drop in the stock value prior to the corrective disclosure, with a suggestion that that drop in stock value may likely not be attributable to the fraud? Can the court not credit that inference at the lead plaintiff stage?
No. At the lead plaintiff stage, and really until the presumption is rebutted, I'm talking about the fraud in the market presumption now. Under the fraud in the market presumption, under BASIC, the purchase price of a plaintiff or a move-in has the alleged fraud reflected in the purchase price. And that link between the purchase price and the alleged fraud is presumptively on the side of the plaintiffs, unless and until defendants rebut the presumption.
So you think Dura just comes in later? It just is not relevant at whatever limitation Dura imposes is just not relevant at the lead plaintiff stage?
This court need not answer whether Dura is relevant at this stage or not. For the facts in this case, Ms. Anthalia has the largest and the same losses under actual or approximate loss and Dura. A traditional Dura analysis only excludes profits and gains where there has been a sale. Ms. Anthalia never sold during the class period or during the 90-day look-back period. So in this case, there is no need for Dura to apply to exclude any losses. And so her loss number is the same, irregardless. Admittedly, if this court wanted to decide whether or not Dura applied, there is definitely a much more fact-based analysis when looking at Dura, and it would be delving into the merits of the case to make a true determination of Dura. As this Ninth Circuit has said in Kavanaugh, the loss calculation should be logical and consistently applied. It seems to be illogical and inconsistent to perhaps have one loss calculation done at the lead plaintiff stage only to have a different loss calculation or damage calculation being done at a later stage in the case.
Well, I'm not sure why that would be irrational in and of itself. I mean, there's these decisions have to be made early, and so there's less information to work with, and so that might well happen, that the specific mechanisms of the damages calculation could get adjusted over the course of litigation. I'm not sure why in and of itself that would be a problem.
Well, in this particular complaint, as in the majority of securities fraud class action complaints, the allegation is that the stock price is artificially inflated throughout the class period as a result of the alleged fraud, i.e. defendant's statements. Most of the time, it's usually based on statements. And so at the lead plaintiff stage and at the motion to dismiss stage, those allegations are accepted as true unless it plausibly cannot be true that the stock price is not inflated as a result of the alleged fraud.
Yeah, what's interesting about this case is that both you and your opposing counsel are sort of repeat and sophisticated players in this space. So I'll ask them the same question I'm asking you, which is, what is the rule that you want courts to apply?
Our position is that it just needs to be consistent application. And in that consistent application, we believe that the actual purchase prices should always be used, whether or not Dura or approximate loss or any other methodology is out there, the actual purchase prices should be used. Otherwise, you are asking the lower courts to delve into the merits of the case and determine what other artificial price to use in order to measure losses or damages.
So your argument, as I understood it from the brief, was that you want us to provide some guidance as to what the proper accounting method would be to determine the losses in the stage of selecting the lead counsel. But that seems to cut against the suggestion that the district court committed clear error here. If there isn't clear guidance, and in fact it's within the district court's discretion to select an accounting method, how could we find that there was a clear error and to merit pretty extraordinary mandamus relief?
Here, as in In re Mercio, The key aspect of it is that the lower court's rulings are inconsistent with the plain text of the PSLRA. In enacting the PSLRA in 1995, one of the major changes it made was codifying the traditional out-of-pocket measure of damages, which uses the actual purchase price. Before the PSLRA, lead plaintiffs were appointed based on first to file. And with the 1995 PSLRA, the change was to the plaintiff with the greatest financial interest in the case. And the Ninth Circuit, in interpreting that, has declined to opine on the actual methodology to determine the greatest financial interest, as long as it's rational and consistently applied.
But that doesn't that mean, then, that there can be no clear error if the Ninth Circuit has given discretion to the courts to just make a reasonable determination?
That would only be true if the methodology being chosen also followed the text of the PSLRA. It is still clear error.
That's not what the Ninth Circuit said, but that's how you're interpreting the Ninth Circuit's decision?
The Ninth Circuit deferred on choosing a loss calculation because it wasn't a question before the court. Because there has been now a wide range of different calculations and a small minority of courts who've chosen to do a calculation which does not use an actual purchase price and which makes very early findings of fact before discovery has been done, before full theories of the fraud have been formalized, and even before all the facts have even materialized. For example, in this case, the Stadium Capital has filed an amended complaint which alleges a second corrective disclosure. And that second, in this district and in others, in multiple disclosure cases, approximate or actual loss is applied. And applying that here, under the amended complaint with a second corrective disclosure, Ms. Santhalia has over $600,000 in losses versus Stadium Capital has over $358,000 in losses. And so it would make more consistency in order to apply a method that doesn't just change with how many corrective disclosures there are or whether the stock price during a class period decreases or increases, because those are deciding loss causation requires experts and requires documents. Making that very preliminary finding before any facts have been gathered or experts heard from seems very inappropriate.
So you just think that loss causation just cannot be part of the lead plaintiff calculation? Like when you're calculating financial interest at the outset of these cases and you have a complaint, the district court essentially cannot make a loss causation part of that determination?
Yes.
And your basis for that is the text of the PSLRA, the cap?
The text of the PSLRA, including the statutory cap, as well as the other clear part of the PSLRA, which it was mandating a discovery stay until and unless the case gets past a motion to dismiss. And so,
why is that? Why is the discovery stay relevant to this argument?
Because using any other price but the actual purchase price would require a merits-based analysis. So, for example, as Your Honor was noting, the fact that in this case the stock price decreased during the class period would seem to indicate that decline was not related to the alleged fraud. But at the same time, using any other purchase price would basically equate Ms. Santhalia's position as an early class period member who bought very close to when the first misrepresentations were made, when the price of the class, the stock was $12.91. It would put her in the same position as those class members who bought just before the end of the class period, which doesn't make any sense because the class members who bought later in the class period technically have issues with standing because they weren't holding any stock when the initial representations were made. And the PSLRA has nothing that supports favoring early period class members versus late period class members. And that's what I mean when we're going really into the weeds and the merits of these cases when you're trying to, when the lower court is making a determination as to whether or not to use the actual purchase price, rather than just accepting as true the purchase prices being what they are and that they were artificially inflated by the alleged fraud.
But doesn't the statute, you're relying on what you view to be the plain text of the statute, but the statute itself says that the district court's to apply a presumption that the most adequate plaintiff, quote, in the determination of the court, has the largest financial interest in the relief sought by the class. And then earlier in the statute, it declares that the court is to determine the most capable, the counsel most capable of adequately representing the class. So it seems that the plain text of the statute makes this a discretionary determination on part of the district judge. And there doesn't seem to be any language that provides an accounting method or limitations on how the district judge reaches this decision. So how do you reconcile, I don't understand how you reconcile what you consider plain text of the statute with the plain text that puts this clearly within the district court's discretion.
The plain text of the statute relating to the capping of the damages specifically lays out and utilizes the purchase price. In every case that has looked at damages in securities class action cases from Affiliated Ute in the Supreme Court and since Blackie versus Barack in the Ninth Circuit has used the out-of-pocket measure for damages. And the out-of-pocket measure for damages uses the actual purchase price. The PSLRA did not change anything about that out-of-pocket measure for damages except with regard to the sale price. And the sale price was putting a cap on whether the stock continued to decrease or increase during the 90 days after the class period. If Congress had intended to also alter or change the use of the actual purchase price and the out-of-pocket measure for damages, Congress would have done so. They did not do so. The formula that they laid out is precisely what Ms. Santhalia has, is somebody who purchased during the class period and continued to retain those shares through the end of the class period, suffered losses only when the corrective disclosure was made, and as a result of the corrective disclosure being made, the price of the stock decreased, and she retained through the 90-day period. And so that her damage calculation is precisely laid out in the PSLRA. It would not make sense to then go in and replace that actual purchase price with any other price of the mark of the stock during this class period.
All right, thank you, counsel. You've exceeded your time. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal. We'll hear from respondent.
Good morning. I'm Kathleen Herkinoff from Kaplan, Fox & Kielsheimer on behalf of Real Party and Interstadium Capital, LLC, the court-appointed lead plaintiff. I would appreciate reserving a few minutes of rebuttal time. I'll keep my eye on the clock.
Well, you don't get rebuttal time.
I'm sorry. Then I won't. But proceeding on, I think that the court here this morning has asked some very pointed questions that align with the presentation we presented. And again, I think we have to go back to what the Bauman factors are. First of all, did the court commit a clear error here? And that is a very significant Bauman factor, in fact, may be dispositive of this entire proceeding. And when we look, as Judge Beatty pointed out, at the text of the PSLRA, it says that the court appoints in its determination the lead plaintiff with the greatest financial interest in the relief sought by the class. And I'll note that doesn't say greatest financial loss. And as this court pointed out in Kavanaugh, one of the things you look at is who has the most to gain. So I think that that is exactly why this court in Kavanaugh many years ago wisely said the greatest financial interest should be determined based on whether it's rational and consistently applied methodology. It's not damages. We realize that the portion of the 90-day look-back cap was applied for the sale price. That was agreed by the parties, as the court pointed out in its order at page 13 in the joint submission. It's used in Ms. Santhalia's middle approach of I think she calls it the Eichenholz dura-adjusted LIFO approach. So I think that the entire discussion of the 90-day look-back is a little bit off point here. The fact remains this court, the district court, followed an irrational and consistent methodology. It applied Dura and it applied Kavanaugh and was not required to apply LIFO or any other proposed methodology. The Ninth Circuit gave it that discretion and, in fact, indicated the importance of giving the district courts that level of discretion. So when you dovetail that back into the Bauman factors and you look at clear error, as the panel noted this morning, there is a point at whether the court, did it violate Ninth Circuit law? No, it did not. Did it violate the terms of the statute? No, it did not. The terms of the statute that apply to the lead plaintiff process only say that the court in its determination can appoint the plaintiff or the movement with the largest financial interest in the relief sought by the class.
So if the district court had just done LIFO, would that have been clear error?
That would be a writ question, right? We'd have to analyze that as to whether that was clear error. I think here in this fact scenario, under this case, yes, it would have been, because the stock price had been declining over time. So I think the court looked very carefully at the underlying record here and determined that based on the fact that the stock price was declining and also the fact that certain of the plaintiffs here, including Ms. Santhalia, have purchased so far back in the class period that the decline has to be discounted, if you will, to conform with Dura.
So you think it's appropriate for the district court at this stage to perform some kind of rough loss causation analysis as part of choosing the lead plaintiff?
It happened here, and I believe it's correct, yes.
And you mentioned one of the factors you mentioned here that you think makes this methodology appropriate here was the decline in the stock price prior to the corrective disclosure. Are there any other factors that would guide a district court in terms of when to use LIFO versus when to use the methodology that was chosen here?
Well, I again think in this case it was the single corrective disclosure drop and the declining stock price. And the court certainly looked at the fact, as it indicated in the record, that Ms. Santhalia's last purchase, I think, was in February of 2021 at a high of, I think it was $10.79. And so I think the court weighed all of those factors, which again is why I believe this is so appropriately left to the court's determination, because the number of cases they consider with these issues on a daily basis, they have varying stock class periods that are proposed by people, different types of securities. There's so many things that go into a court's analysis. And here, this court, on these facts, with the declined stock price, made the appropriate determination. And there is no clear error. There's no clear violation of the PSRA. The damages cap that's discussed is not mandated that the court follow that under the clear text of the PSRA. There is no language there. And if the PSRA wanted to say that the lead plaintiff decision is based on damages, it would have said so. There was no reason to not put that in if that was their intent. And we look at the words of the statute, and the words of the statute give the court discretion in its determination. And then when you apply that again under the Bauman factors, which is the only reason we're here, is her petition for writ of mandamus, she doesn't meet the factors.
I know, like you're opposing counsel, you probably practice in this area frequently. Is it your sense that the district court decisions in this area, at least in our circuit, are roughly consistent on this accounting question, or that they are not consistent?
I think the ones that have been made are all rational and consistently apply for the facts in those particular cases. And again, we cannot second guess those district courts. They're the ones viewing the record, the complaints that are at issue there. So no, I don't believe that there is any discordant approach within the district courts in the Ninth Circuit. And I certainly think that all the district courts are mindful of Dura and take a look. And they obviously also take a look at the arguments presented by the litigants before them. And sometimes litigants decide to make arguments and sometimes they don't. Here, the record before the court, we proposed these three different methodology. The court asked us to submit a joint submission, so there was no issue over whether any calculation was in dispute. These are the figures, and these are the facts that the court had to look at. And under those facts, this court made a rational decision that with the stock price declining, and the profile of the three loss scenarios, under which I will note, under the first one, LIFO, our client is very close to Ms. Santhalia's loss. And I don't think that we need to get into this debate, but there are other factors that the courts can look at, such as, you know, the amount of net shares purchased, the amount expended, and our client had higher figures on certain of those thresholds as well. But at the end of the day, the court chose the approach that was applied in Enphase and has been applied by Judge Gilliam in the Marquette case, applied by a District of Nevada judge, and took the price immediately before the drop to base as the purchase. And that isn't a false price. That's a price. It just may not be the price these two particular individuals bought at. But if you look at the middle approach, that is also a bit of a value, an average of pricing. So here, these were figures presented by agreement of the parties, and the court made a rational determination, and there is no basis to submit that she erred, either under the PSRA or the applicable law of Kavanaugh.
Is there anything artificial about the district court's analysis in the sense that as the case proceeds, I imagine you're not going to argue that the damages here are really capped by the $5.18 share price right before the corrective disclosure? I take it you're going to want to go back in time and say, well, we bought the stock for much higher than $5.18, and there's some amount of loss north of $5.18 that is attributable to the fraud. In that sense, the district court's determination seems pretty conservative at the outset.
Well, as it should be, because at the outset we're not determining damages, and we don't have discovery, as counsel has pointed out. So that's why, again, this analysis at the initial stage is not about damages. It is about greatest financial interest, who has the most to gain. And under the third approach, as we noted, Santhali actually had a positive result. And I think the court looked at all those factors and determined that in this case, Stadium Capital was the most appropriate lead plaintiff. And I've seen nothing that would suggest to the contrary, nor any clear error by this court in following either the terms of the PSRA or applicable Kavanaugh law. Have I sufficiently answered your question, Your Honor?
Yeah, I think you have. Thank you.
Counsel, your friend on the other side suggested, they suggested that we should provide some clarity. There should be some more specificity about what sorts of accounting methods should be used. Do you agree with that? Do you think this is a situation where we need to wade in and choose one method over the other or provide additional guidance?
No, I do not, Your Honor, because, again, I think the district court is the most appropriate court to make that determination. As the PSRA acknowledges, that is the court that is evaluating the nitty-gritty of the facts before it, the number of complaints that have been filed, whether people are alleging different class periods. There are so many things that the court needs that discretion to make that decision. And certainly the law of Kavanaugh has been in place since 2002. The PSRA has been in place since 1995. And I don't think that any further clarity is needed to provide more guidance, because I think that any more guidance would be more restrictive and potentially not able to match the underlying variations that the district courts are going to see in these cases over time. So I think that I actually believe that the Kavanaugh decision was very wisely stated in its point, and the PSRA, I believe, also very wisely indicated not damages, but financial interest in the court's determination. Because again, it's that court, the district court, who has the competing movements before it for lead plaintiff. And certainly over time, as you go forward in the case, facts can change and expand. I will note that the amended complaint, while I appreciate Ms. Santhalia noting our efforts, which we have been continuing in the case, it is not appropriate, in my opinion, for her to read into the record loss figures that are not part of the record before the court, nor were part of the record before the district court when it made its decision back in February of 2022. Those are all post-events. So again, we're here today to talk about whether the district court committed clear error in its initial order. And I will also note that the court gave Ms. Santhalia plenty of opportunity to convince it otherwise by filing a motion for reconsideration, which was also denied. And the district court here, of course, put in its response to this court indicating why it felt it chose the most appropriate method to apply here. And I don't have, unless the court has additional questions, I suppose there are some points in Ms. Santhali's presentation I could comment on, but I again also want to go back to the Bauman factors, and one of them being this court in Z7 Fund made clear that these lead plaintiff decisions can be revisited on appeal. So this writ mandamus petition doesn't meet the standards. It's not well-founded. There is not a misapplication of federal rules. None of the other Bauman factors weigh in favor of granting this writ, and I think the clear error factor is essentially a death knell here for Ms. Santhalia's position. And if I could speak briefly, she mentioned Mersho as one of the cases where the court went back and looked at a lead plaintiff decision. Well, again, in that case, the issue wasn't financial interest. It was once the largest financial interest individual was appointed, there was some rumblings, they called it misgivings, about the cohesiveness of the group appointed. And the Ninth Circuit said that the court inappropriately considered misgivings as opposed to evidence on that issue, and there was nothing in the record to suggest to the contrary. Based on the declarations that the parties had submitted, there was no basis to say that they were not cohesively aligned, if you will. So again, if you also look at the writs, the few writs that have gone up, they're all on very specific issues of PSRA violations where the court jumps over a person it decides has the largest financial interest because of some concern over a fee agreement, or appoints the one with the largest financial interest but then gives them different counsel. And as this court is aware under the PSRA, once that lead plaintiff is appointed, it has the ability essentially to have its lead counsel appointed subject to approval of the court. I won't go into that analysis, but again, that's a very specific provision, wholly unlike what we have here. And this petition here is only about financial interest and the relief sought by the class, and there are no presumptions or issues that come into effect on Twombly on that. It's simply the raw data that was submitted to the court and the court looking at the stock price decline. So I don't think at this stage talking about merits or damages is what the PSRA intended. And if the court has no further questions, we submit that Ms. Santhali's petition should be denied.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Let's have 1 minute for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I would just like to remind the court that Dura was a case decided at the pleading stage, and the only thing that Dura decided was that in adequately pleading loss causation, a plaintiff must also plead a stock drop related to a corrective disclosure. There was nothing in Dura that says anything about the purchase price. And with regard to the text of the PSLRA, there's nothing that would in the PSLRA that says that the lead plaintiff calculation should not follow the statutory cap set forth in the PSLRA. The courts that have interpreted this, most particularly in RAP and in Salastro, have rejected the idea or concept that the actual purchase prices should not be used. The PSRA sets forth a very clear three-step process for appointing a lead plaintiff, and nowhere in it does it indicate that actual purchase prices should not be used. The greatest financial interest in this case would be Ms. Santhalia, who, looking at the three different methodologies put forth, clearly she has the largest losses under two of the more majority-held calculations, whether under actual or traditional Dura. There's no reason to discount her shares simply because she did not sell anything during the class period. That would be extending Dura beyond even what has been preliminarily done at the lead plaintiff stage. Dura, until except for a handful of cases, have only applied to exclude profits and losses from trades, from sales made during the class period. There's no reason to extend Dura beyond to include just declines in the stock price. I see my time is up. Do you have any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. That completes our calendar for the morning. We are in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All rise.